supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to Common Space, a collaboration between WHYY and First Person Arts. I'm Jamie J., your host. Well, with all the attention paid to Christmas during the holiday season, it can be easy to forget that it isn't the only holiday being observed at this time of the year. So, we have a trio of folks here in the studio with us with their stories of celebrating two other major holidays of the season, Hanukkah and Kwanzaa. A little later, we'll have frequent First Person Arts slam performer Marjorie Winther and WHYY's own Annette John Hall, who's a reporter at the Keystone Crossroads Project. But first up, we're speaking with Lisa Lapp. She's a Philadelphia-area-based freelance copy editor. And Lisa is proud to say that if you can decipher the storage instructions on your bottle of Advil, you have her to thank for it. But she's also proud of preserving the legacy of celebrating Hanukkah in a way that honors her family's history and yet makes it their own special holiday. Lisa, welcome to Common Space.
Thank you.
So I'm intrigued by this idea that three generations of your family celebrating Hanukkah, and you've made it quite unique. So can you tell me about that? How did your family originally celebrate Hanukkah?
Well, originally, I only know from my growing up, we had it like most middle-class Reform Jewish Americans do. We weren't even Reform. We were very secular. We just had the seven nights of lights and we had presents. And we read a prayer from a piece of paper that I had left over from a Jewish nursery school I attended that was colored on one side and had a phonetic prayer on the other side. I remember the orange and purple coloring on one side. And we would read this phonetic prayer as we lit the candles. This was when I was little. I should give you the context of it, though. Why it would be so minimal, our celebration, was my grandfather, David Lapp, around 1920, so almost 100 years ago, went to yeshiva, went to rabbinical school, and questioned the existence of God in school. And it wasn't that he didn't believe in God, it's that he wanted to know. He wanted to know, how do you know? And I'm told that that was why he was kicked out of school.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and he remained agnostic the rest of his life, and he was very clear about that with me, that he wasn't atheist, it was just that he was said you can never know. However, he also was a great scholar. I mean, he had studied, so he taught us stories. So we had that. Meanwhile, he raised his family kind of in a secular way. My father grew up hating organized religion and wanted no part of it in our house, and my mother decided she was okay with that. So we had only the very minimal. We would go to Yom Kippur dinner at someone else's house. Not dinner. We would go to Yom Kippur something. I forget. That's how secular I am. We'd do a Passover dinner at someone else's house, and we had Hanukkah because that's what you did in America. And we did this for years until we had my grandfather over for dinner once on Hanukkah, and he was listening to us go through. We were so proud we were doing our ritual. We went through it, and he listened, and he said, "Why are you saying the Purim prayer for Hanukkah?" And we had never had any idea that this little piece of paper I had wasn't even a Hanukkah prayer.
Oh, my.
So that kind of killed it. I don't know if we kept doing it after that. I think that we didn't do it after that because we didn't know what to do since we didn't have the right prayer. So that was as far as our practice went in my family when I was growing up. That was it. So I grew up. I got married. I had two children. We got divorced. I was a single mother. And I started to become interested in creating rituals for our family, original rituals.
Why was that important?
Well, I knew that I didn't have a strong cultural background to pass on other than, you know, Jewish comedy is very important in our family, that kind of thing. But in terms of ritual, we really didn't have anything. The freedom that not having religion in my house gave me was it gave me no pre-programmed beliefs or pre-programmed ideas so that I felt like I was free to choose my own.
You almost had to, because without a cultural context, you really had nothing on the holidays to build from, so you had to have something.
I had appearances. I had what I saw people doing, but I didn't know what they were doing or what it meant. So because Hanukkah is a big deal in America, I think mainly because of Christmas, you need to have something going on while your friends were celebrating Christmas. I looked into what Hanukkah was. I didn't even know. And from what I could tell, it was about a battle, and it was about who won, and it was about that the oppressed people made it with the miracle of the oil lasting for 8 nights. And I didn't want to have our ritual be about that. I didn't want it to be about battle and about that. So I felt that the what was the lesson we could take from it would be that it was about freedom of belief, that the people in their temple who were being attacked were able to preserve their belief and preserve their practice. So my kids and I created this ritual. We lit the candles. We got the real prayers from somewhere. And after we lit the candles and said the prayer, each of us would say something that we personally believe that nobody could take from us because you can believe what you want. And we did this every night of Hanukkah for a number of years. And it really became really a valuable tradition for us. We looked forward to it. And also, at some point in this process of years, very much interwoven in this, was our growing together as a single-parent family. There was the fact that their dad left for Florida and didn't see them very much after that. So there was their beliefs that came up that year was like about pain and about loss. It was really something.
So you have with you a book.
Yeah, this is the book that I used since the kids were very little just to write down things they said.
Okay, so I see you have some markers in the book.
I have more
so
markers.
So would you share with us some of the gems?
From the second night, this was 1991, so he was 8, she was 5. My son David said, I believe everyone in the world can live together in peace. And Paige said, I believe in very old people.
Wow.
So then we skip forward to 1994. David said, I know I won't believe in God until it's proven, but I do believe that there's something like God in everyone. And then he added, well, almost everyone. And then he said, actually, it is everyone, but with some people, you need a jackhammer to find it. And this was just about when his dad was leaving.
Okay.
So that was like that happening. And Paige said, I have 2, but they're short. I believe in God and I believe in angels. David said the next night, I believe in it, that everyone in this family loves each other. And Paige said, I believe Daddy will have a good life in Florida. The next night, David said, I believe that no one can change my beliefs without my consent. On the next night, Paige said, I believe we will have a good life in our new house. And I wrote, believe you never know when something bad happening will turn out to be a gift. That was that year.
I'm especially taken by this, by two things. One, the way you're fondly looking at these pages and remembering these moments.
Oh my God. It's so hard not to read you the stuff in between that has nothing to do with Hanukkah because they're so great. 1995, Mom, me, says, I believe in God. That was a big deal for me.
So what was the change that precipitated that?
I just felt so many things conspiring together to have my life work in a way that was almost supernatural. It was really, you know, and also it was, I've told my daughter this already, that having a daughter who is so pure of heart, it's hard not to believe in God when you have that, you know.
So what would your grandfather say about how you changed the holiday?
Oh, I think he'd love it. He would love that I looked at not that there was a battle, but what was the essence of it.
So what do your kids do now, and how do they talk about the holiday?
They don't talk about the holiday, but what they do.
Okay.
What they do now, let's see. My son David is a journalist. It's what he's always wanted to be. He reports on federal environmental policy in Washington. Okay. He loves it. My daughter is a voiceover artist, and she lives in New York City.
And do they come home for Hanukkah?
No. It's not a big holiday, really.
Okay. I mean,
even though we had our ritual, it was a ritual of us as a family growing together. I think if they happened to be visiting around that time, it would be, then yeah, we do it because we still value it, but they don't gather for it.
But isn't that what's really important when we connect a holiday to real life and allow it to help us grow and grow in a positive way? You know, I mean, I think you created a model that a lot of families.
Mm-hmm. Because it's very simple.
So I want to ask you about the changing beliefs
mm-hmm.
that you witnessed as a result
right.
of tracking this. What was the most powerful change?
Oh, it was an underlying change. I think that this ritual, as small as it was treasured, and it allowed us to get in touch with our beliefs. It preserved a thread of identifying ourselves as a Jewish family that had some Jewish practice, so that when my mother invited my son David to study Torah because she had regretted that she was not passing down her tradition, he accepted the invitation, and he decided to study Torah and become a bar mitzvah. And when my daughter heard the music in synagogue, she said it sounded very mysterious, so she wanted to do it too.
Wow.
So we ended up joining a synagogue out of this. This wasn't a direct result, but I know that this is what established our sense of being Jewish, this ritual.
In terms of the beliefs that you mm-hmm. and your children articulated every year at mm-hmm. Hanukkah,
yeah.
are you aware of or did you witness a really compelling change in anyone's beliefs? I know you said, I believe in God now.
Right. So the last entry I have is for 1998, and that was the year Paige did her bat mitzvah. Paige said, I believe that life is wonderful. David said, I believe that if an act is good, then the reasons behind it can be excused. Huh. And I said, I believe I probably have nothing left to teach you to.
Wow.
And I'd like to also read, for David, I want to mm-hmm. read in his bar mitzvah, I brought what he wrote there, which is an extension, I think, of the whole Hanukkah ritual.
Okay.
Because he used his bar mitzvah ceremony as a time to explore his place in Judaism as an atheist.
Okay.
So what he did, he was assigned by the rabbi to interview somebody from every branch of Judaism okay. and ask them questions about different things about their experience of Judaism, but especially what their concept of God is. And do you feel that a person who doesn't believe in God can be Jewish? So he said, this is not to say I don't believe in the divine spark that Reconstructionism calls God. We had joined the Reconstructionist synagogue. I just do not think of it as divine. I see it as what makes humanity unique. It's what separates us from everything else. As to the question of believing in something outside yourself, what I believe in as outside myself is humanity, the whole of life that I have a responsibility to. In light of all this, I choose to be a Reconstructionist Jew because its beliefs, particularly its emphasis on the sanctity of humanity, are closest to what I believe. When the ceremony was over, my dad's cousin Mike, who was in his 80s at the time, who knew my grandfather very well, came over to me and he said, the reason that your grandfather was kicked out of rabbinical school was because he was asking questions just like David was asking. Isn't that great?
Wow.
That's what my grandfather would love, to see that his great-grandson, who has his name, found a place in Judaism for himself and was able to question and be there and be accepted.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, that book seems like it is such a treasure trove of your family's history. And I love this idea of being able to track your growth and evolution as a family and see how this ritual played a part in deepening people's experiences.
The insight that I got into this by preparing this talk with you today, that my daughter's very first entry at age 5, when she said, I believe those candles are beautiful, I'd have to say that that pretty much summarizes the meaning of it all. It's of the holiday. This lets me see a symbolism in the Hanukkah candles being that it's the flame that persists of the sense of connection with the past and connection with what it means to be Jewish and the connection with the freedom to believe what you believe.
Beautifully said. So, Lisa, what did you think would be important as you thought about how you and your kids would celebrate?
Well, I thought it would be important that it would be something that they could relate to just as kids, that it would have a sacred feeling about it, and that it would be true to the actual meaning of the holiday as I understand it.
I think it's a great ritual. Clearly, from the beginning to the end, you know, it was bookended by positive affirmations mm-hmm. that showed growth.
And I would say also that even with the struggling ones, with the loss, they were trying to find strength in themselves in what they said.
Well, thank you, Lisa Lapp, for talking with us here at Common Space about Hanukkah. We wish you and your family an awesome holiday season.
Thank you.
Okay. Again, you're listening to Common Space, a collaboration between WHYY and First Person Arts, and it's been supported by the Pew Center for Arts and Heritage. Now, joining us now is Annette John Hall, who's a reporter at WHYY News and the Keystone Crossroads Project. You might also remember her from her former life as a columnist at the Philadelphia Inquirer. Also with us is Marjorie Winther, a frequent performer at First Person Art Story Slams. Annette and Marjorie have slightly varying degrees of commitment to celebrating their holidays, with equally variant degrees of good humor. Annette, how about you start us off with a description of your Kwanzaa holiday traditions?
Well, I almost feel like ashamed to confess this, but we do sort of like a bootleg Kwanzaa celebration at my
okay.
house.
Okay.
We did it with another family when our kids were very, very young, and we wanted to instill in them the various principles Kwanzaa espouses. But we did not celebrate the entire week of Kwanzaa. We picked a day during Kwanzaa week, and we gathered, and then we would light the candles of the days that we missed. Like, say, if we got together the fourth day of Kwanzaa, we would light the four candles previous to that, and then light the other ones because we wouldn't get together after that. So that's sort of how we do it.
Okay, so now the principles of Kwanzaa.
Yes.
Are?
The ones that I remember are self-determination, purpose, cooperative economics, creativity, faith. There are seven, and I can't remember all of them, but all of them are well worth trying to instill in your children.
So what I know about Kwanzaa is that it's a holiday that was founded by Maulana Karenga, and he was the founder of what we now know as Black Studies
right.
in schools. And Kwanzaa is a celebration that happens the day after Christmas, that week between Christmas and New Year's. And one of the reasons why it was strategically placed then was to take advantage of the after Christmas benefits. So if we were buying Kwanzaa gifts after Christmas, the idea was that we'd get a better deal, you know, in Kwanzaa stuff, not to imply that Kwanzaa was just, you know, about catching sales. So I want to tell you guys, here are the principles of Kwanzaa. Umoja, which is unity. Kujichagulia, self-determination. Ujima, collective work and responsibility. Ujama, cooperative economics. Nia, purpose. Kumba, creativity. And Imani, faith.
In what language is that?
Kiswahili.
The thing that I should add is, we ask the kids to pick a principle that they're going to try to focus on throughout the year. And we write it down. And when we gather the following year, we ask our kids what they have fulfilled or accomplished in regard to that principle. And then they tell us, and then we pick principles to try to follow for the coming year. So I think the kids have really, really taken that to heart. Mm-hmm. And the kids have gotten closer because of it. And it's funny, they're the ones, Mom, are we having Kwanzaa this year? I never see them. You know, I never see them the rest of the year.
Right, right.
But they really look forward to the Kwanzaa celebration.
Do you celebrate with any particular meal or food choices?
Oh, my gosh. That's what they love about it. we cook what the kids like, and they like my lasagna, and they like a particular cake that I make, so I make that. And then we have fried chicken, we have potato salad, we have just stuff that the kids really ask for, and we've been doing that over the years as well.
So I used to work for this company, the Freedom Theater, which is uptown in Philadelphia, and Kwanzaa meant a lot at Freedom Theater. And, you know, so every day, you know, you'd have a purpose and the kids would have to wear T-shirts. And even though, you know, many of us didn't, you know, had to be reminded every day what the principle was, it was a sense of community around celebrating Kwanzaa because, you know, Christmas is kind of for everybody and Kwanzaa was for us, us being, you know, those folks that self-identify with African roots. And, you know, it was really a communal kind of thing. So we would greet each other and say, what's the principle of the day?
Habari got
it. We'd resurrect the language that we didn't use. Now, what's interesting about your food celebration and what I know about Kwanzaa, too, is we're not necessarily doing African food.
No.
We're doing the food that we as a community have made our own here in this country that's come down generations. So it might be granny's macaroni and cheese or collard greens or something like that. But it's a really great time.
That's very true. And, you know, we're supposed to display the first fruits, right? And you know, a bounty of fruits. And it's funny, I display fruits in this African bowl, you know, but it's only for social media purposes. None of the kids eat the fruit. Nobody eats the fruit. But we show it because it makes a beautiful picture. And you're absolutely right about, you know, family recipes that have been passed down, traditional African-American foods. But the thing that I have to say about that is it does emphasize African-American culture, but it's certainly inclusive, and we invite everybody who wants to come.
Absolutely. So I'm going to ask you one last question, and then we're going to open up so that we could get Marjorie involved as well. So I want you to think about your most meaningful Kwanzaa celebration, right? Dig deep. What happened that day to make it so meaningful?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I think I would have to say the one of 2013 going into 2014, because my mother was dying. And, you know, I was feeling very emotional about it because she was 3,000 miles away and I was unable to get to see her that Christmas. And so I remember choosing my principle to be faith because I needed to have faith that she was going to be alive long enough for me to get to her. She passed away that February, and I did get to see her right after Kwanzaa. But I was feeling very emotional that Kwanzaa.
So, Marjorie, what are you doing during the holiday season?
Well, I want to comment first on what you guys are talking about, because that just sounds really beautiful to me, to have a holiday that's not commercialized, that is about spiritual values and community. See, it's the gift giving that stresses me out more than anything, because I don't know like what to do. I don't, you know, it's just, I don't like malls. Like, I hate them. I can't even tell you, like, I'm afraid of escalators and I just don't like artificial lights. And but to answer your question, for me, growing up in a family of sort of quasi Jewish atheist lefties, the holidays were just, we didn't have a tradition. Every year it was, what are we going to do this year? I don't know. Are we going to do something this year? I don't know. The thing about Christmas, if you are not a Christian, is you just feel left out. Everyone is doing stuff that you're not doing. And then Hanukkah, this is my take on Hanukkah. And you're going to get letters and you're going to get people objecting. And this is purely my opinion. I'm not a Talmudic scholar. But I think Hanukkah is just a way for American Jews, second generation, who felt left out to, like, do something. Like, it's not really a holiday. What do you do? A dreidel. Oh, this is a thrill. I'm twirling a little top thingy with Hebrew letters. I mean, it's fun for two. Like you say, you would like the Kwanzaa candles like once or.
Yeah.
We didn't, you know. It's like we the first day. I don't even know the prayer. I know the first half, you know, Baruch Atah Adonai. I don't know what's next. And, you know, it's awful.
Well, so okay. But there's a thread here. This idea of feeling left out, needing to feel like you are part of something bigger than yourself. And that's real, you know, and feeling a part of something through a ritual.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, is that what it's all about? Is that what we're really talking about?
It is. Can I tell you what happens at work? And this is just, to me, so symbolic of Hanukkah in America. At work, everybody goes nuts around Christmas. And the whole office is decorated with garlands and lights and cake. And it's just stuff. Out. And then somewhere along the line, someone will, like the diversity coordinator will go, oh, crap, we forgot March. And then, you know, I get to work and there's like some like construction paper menorah taped to my door. And then they ordered it from shesnotlikeus.com. You know? And it's like, I get the intent.
They love you. They clearly love you and don't want you to be left out.
And it's just like, okay, you know what? But I do want to tell, this is my holiday story, that feeling of being left out that right. changed my life for the better, for the worse. Who knows in the long run? But it was Christmas, which I don't celebrate, but it's permeated in the culture. And if I want that, the families who love each other, and, you know, I wanted that. And Christmas is coming. I was like 29. My parents were going to Jamaica. My sister was going to somewhere with her husband, and no one had invited me anywhere. And I was going to be all by myself. And I was freaking out. And one of my coworkers said he was going to drive to Texas, where he was from, to see his family. And I was just like, well, can I come with? And he's like, okay. And so, like, that was our first date. We drove, like, by Missouri. We were, you know.
By Missouri, it was on.
Well, we had gotten to.
It was on.
It is the show me state. Crazy. So that's how I ended up getting married.
That was
yeah.
Wow.
Because we went, I spent Christmas with his family. So they assumed this was a relationship. You know, God forbid I disappoint them. So, you know, ended up, you know, I was pregnant by King's birthday, but that's
all. Oh my God. This is what we call a whirlwind romance, right?
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
So that's how I ended up married, because I didn't want to be alone on Christmas.
Oh, wow. So, Marjorie, what are you celebrating now? What holiday do you celebrate now? Deep sigh. That was Marjorie, not me.
You know, what I do now for Thanksgiving and Christmas, my family's only now really me and my son. I tried to do the, let's have this big community, and I invited like random people like come to my house. Anybody who didn't have family in town was invited, and my son is a little socially awkward, and finally he's like, Mom, could you not, you know, like if we just do our thing? And so now what happens, he comes over at 10 in the morning, we put the bird in the oven, we take the dog, we do about a 4-mile hike through the Wissahickon. We come home, he makes half the sides, I make, and it's lovely.
Yeah.
It's lovely. And it's just the two of us, and it's nice. It's a nice time with
well,
him.
Well, that's why I love Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving is clearly my favorite holiday, because it's about food and family. And I love to cook. And so I'm in there like the day before just cooking a feast, which is totally unnecessary because my family is 3,000 miles away in California, my extended family. And so it's just me and my husband, my daughter, and my son if he chooses to come over. But over the years, we've invited all kinds of strays, people who have nowhere
That's
to go.
Nice. Well, I'm coming to your house
sort of
this
built
year.
A community that
That's
way.
Nice.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to end on that note. Thank you, Annette. Thank you, Marjorie. And happy holidays. You've been listening to Common Space, a collaboration between First Person Arts and WHYY. Common Space has been supported by the Pew Center for Arts and Heritage. Common Space is produced by Mike Villers. Our interim executive producer is Naomi Sterobin. Elizabeth Perez Luna is our executive producer. Our engineer has been Charlie Kyer. And please, if you haven't already, subscribe to Common Space on iTunes or Stitcher. And while you're at it, give us a rating. I'm your host, Jamie J. Thanks for listening.